Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. Before we begin, a quick apology for me. Since the last episode, real life has had the gall to insert itself into my usual bi-weekly cadence on new episodes. So, slightly delayed, this is Episode 8, Ancient Solar Energy, Part 4. In the last episode, we explored the game-changing, in fact, world-changing advances in getting the gaseous form of ancient solar energy, aka natural gas, out of the ground. The wonder twins of fracking and horizontal drilling. With the combination of fracking and horizontal drilling, natural gas production's wonder twin powers were most definitely activated. And not that long ago, it was only in late 2011 that fracked, horizontally drilled wells became the majority in the United States. The outcome has been remarkable. A lot more gas from existing reserves, a lot more gas from otherwise exhausted reserves, and a lot of gas from otherwise inaccessible reserves. More and more and still more natural gas, truly world-changing amounts. But activated for good, for bad, or what? White hats, black hats, or gray hats? All energy is compromise, after all. So what else do we need to know about fracking and horizontal drilling to make sense of the inherent compromises, eyes wide open, in this age of climate change? Well, I promised an entire cowboy movie full of white hats, black hats, and gray hats. Let's saddle up and ride into the fray. Be forewarned, though, we have to tread very carefully as there are a lot of rabbit holes out there. And to avoid the risk of both never-ending episodes and the need to change the name of the podcast to The Shocking Story of Electricity or something, we'll stay pretty high level for now. Fear not, though. It's all part of the larger and profoundly interconnected climate-changing world we are exploring, and we will explore many of these rabbit holes over the course of the series. So back to our cowboys. For the purposes of this episode, I'm going to forego conclusions on white, black, and gray hats. In other words, who is a good guy? Who is a bad guy? And who is somewhere in between? I think you'll see why as we go. With that caveat, let's start with natural gas's benefits, which I categorize into three thematic and alliterative categories: economic, environmental, and electric. As we've seen, natural gas has created significant economic benefits, and for the avoidance of doubt, I am firmly of the opinion that prosperity is a fundamental good for humanity. Natural gas has been very good for human prosperity. An adaptable, transportable, and relatively inexpensive source of heat and chemistry. That's a big economic benefit intuitively, although it is difficult to find truly objective analysis out there on exactly what the impact has been and is, I think for two main reasons. First, the data. Natural gas and oil are so tightly interconnected from an exploration and production standpoint, the one we've been talking about so far, that teasing them apart is often tricky. Second, the economic and policy biases. Everyone who studies natural gas, it seems, has an interest in the outcome of their study. From business people boosting their businesses, to policymakers boosting their policies, to politicians boosting their economies, to advocates advocating for whatever outcome. These biases are not a bad thing in and of themselves. They are a human thing, me included, of course, and always worth keeping in mind. In my experience, finding not just objective analysis, but objective analysis that we can all be confident is in fact objective, say that 10 times fast, is beyond my small brain and limited resources. Or, in the immortal wisdom of rap legend's Public Enemy, don't believe the hype. Now, hype aside, we can confidently say that when it comes to electricity generation, jobs and taxes, and natural gas-driven products like fertilizer, natural gas has been a game changer. I'll pause here to say that that energy-food nexus, of which natural gas and fertilizer are a key part, is fascinating, and I think way under-discussed. I can't wait to get to that nexus in a future episode. As we'll see as we go deeper into the power system, natural gas has been a game changer and in many different ways. I've mentioned that natural gas has emerged as both the swing vote in the race to decarbonize electricity, and as a high-impact multi-position player in the system itself. Here are two perhaps surprising examples that we'll unpack soon. First, natural gas-fired power generation, because of its inherent flexibility, has been the key to bringing large quantities of renewable energy into the power system while maintaining reliable, affordable power supplies. Second, natural gas-fired power generation, fueled by abundant, low-cost fracked and horizontally drilled natural gas, has also been the key to maintaining affordable power supplies as renewable energy costs have come down from eye-wateringly high prices only a decade or so ago. Given electricity's expanding and crucial role in our economies and societies, and as we continue to electrify, the regressive nature of electricity price increases, this is a big, big deal. Switching gears to an environmental perspective, it's seemingly simple. Natural gas is better than coal or oil. In terms of climate change, burning natural gas produces less greenhouse gas, about half the GHG as opposed to burning coal. Although, as we've noted, with where the fuel comes from, the way it's processed, and the way it's burned all have a notable impact on its emissions. In terms of air pollution, burning natural gas also produces less gaseous and particulate matter pollution than coal or oil, with the same caveat about origin, processing, and burning method. That's just the white hat perspective, though. More realistically, I think it's gray. A better compromise, but still a compromise, and not a great one. So let's take a dive into that. From exploration and production, finding the gas and getting it out of the ground, to transportation like pipelines and gas storage facilities, and all the way to burning of the gas and beyond. We start with the well itself, which, depending on where you live, may be out of sight, out of mind, or right next door. Perhaps quite recently right next door. There are three major concerns: water, earthquakes, and methane leaks. First, water. Lots and lots and lots of water, like 1.5 million to almost 10 million gallons per well. For perspective, the average person in the U.S. uses 80 to 100 gallons per day. So even if we use the high end per person and the low end per well, just to make it look as judicious as possible, that's still the equivalent daily water use of 100,000 people per well. And at the high end, 1.2 million people per well. That 1.5 to 10 million gallons per well is then multiplied by some portion of the approximately 1 million wells in the U.S. alone. Now, that may be a good use for that water. I'll leave it to you to decide the color of the various hats, so to speak. But the scale is almost beyond human comprehension, mine at least. and then consider all that water in the context of droughts, habitat loss, and alternative uses like, say, drinking water. But as we've discussed last time, it's not just water going into the ground. It's also things like methanol, benzene, diesel fuel, hydrogen fluoride, lead, sulfuric acid, and formaldehyde, all added to make fracking more effective. In fact, that water might carry some combination of hundreds of different chemicals, many of which are toxic, many linked to reproductive and developmental health issues, plus any radioactivity that the water picks up on its subterranean travels, which can be quite a bit, plus many more that are either undisclosed, with drillers citing trade secrets, and or of undetermined toxicity. Now multiply that water by those chemicals, billions and billions of gallons of contaminated water worldwide. And it is important to note, billions and billions of gallons of opportunity cost of other things that we could do with that water. So listen up, all you innovators and entrepreneurs. Until we get to a methane-free world, or close to it, we need to make fracking less water-intensive and toxic chemical-intensive. We need to make better ways to treat and reuse that water and to clean up the messes we've already made. Opportunity is calling. Let's answer. So, a big call to action, an opportunity to do good and to do well. Terrible pun on the word well, sorry. Now, back to fracking. As the underground rock is fractured, now that's the point of fracking, remember, that contaminated water can leak into both underground aquifers and surface waters. Often the rock formations act as a natural barrier, often they do not. Plus leaks and spills. In other words, drinking water, irrigation water, habitat, recreation. Some of that contaminated water comes back to the surface by design, where it can be reused to frack more wells. It's still contaminated, of course, and more stays in the ground with each injection, so reuse is far from a complete solution. The returned water can also be treated, albeit expensively and only to a certain extent, and then permanently reinjected into deep underground wells or simply released into rivers and lakes. Again, an incomplete solution from an environmental solution perspective, wildly incomplete in the opinion of many. Those cowboy hats are looking a lot grayer than they were even a few minutes ago. Second, earthquakes. Yes, fracking can induce earthquakes. But according to the U.S. Geological Survey, which is the authority on this stuff, it is extremely rare for fracking to cause earthquakes that can be felt on the surface. It makes a sort of intuitive sense. The ambient pressure thousands of feet underground is already incredibly high. And one brief little explosion of hydraulic pressure in a spot somewhere down there is highly unlikely to make the surface of the earth move. But wait, there's more. The much bigger seismic concern comes when post-fracking wastewater is injected into those deep disposal wells. This process, it turns out, is a much more common cause of fracking-related earthquakes than fracking itself. This also makes a sort of intuitive sense. A lot of incompressible water building up over a long time across a wide area. Per the USGS, the built-up seismic pressure can result in felt earthquakes. Put that word can in mental italics. So, the USGS says, most wastewater injection wells are not associated with felt earthquakes. More italics for the word most. Overall, I think it's safe to say that seismic risk, though, pales by comparison to the many water risks. That said, I live in seismically active California and do not want to underestimate the impact of any earthquake on lives and communities. especially those earthquakes that are voluntary, aka related to human activity, rather than involuntary, courtesy of Mother Nature. So, having really scared ourselves on water, and perhaps a little less so on earthquakes, let's turn to our third big risk, methane leaks. As we've discussed, methane, which is the primary ingredient of natural gas, is a powerful greenhouse gas, some 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period, accounting for about one-third of climate change since pre-industrial times, and proliferating faster than ever before. Yikes. But it gets worse. Simultaneous with skyrocketing natural gas volumes resulting from fracking and horizontal drilling, we've come to realize that leaks are a big systemic problem, not a small once-in-a-while nuisance. From production to pipelines and storage to local distribution systems and into homes, businesses, factories, and power plants. We'll pick up there next time, hopefully in a week or so rather than three. Did I mention that natural gas was going to be a little more complicated, a big, healthy dose of necessary complexity? We're almost there, and I'll do my best to wrap up these basics of natural gas in the next episode of Climate Changes Everything. Thanks for listening. Thank you.